I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami, rabbi of Or Chadash Synagogue in Vienna, Austria, and the Liberal Synagogue in Toulouse, France. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim Barel Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I promised on last week's Two Jewish Show to fill you in on my recent rabbinic mission trip to East Central Europe with a group of Reform rabbis and spouses. In January, we visited Vienna and Budapest and Prague, including a side trip to the Theresienstadt concentration camp. All three cities were extremely interesting. All three Jewish communities are dealing with issues of identity formation in ways we cannot easily imagine here in America. Each of these places has strengths and challenges, and I'll talk more about the Jews of Budapest, Hungary next week. Our guest today is the Reform Rabbi in Vienna, Austria, Lior Bar-Ami, and you'll hear more about that community in just a few moments. I'll begin with some of the fascinating Jewish experiences that we had in Prague in the Czech Republic. Prague is an incredibly beautiful city, even in the dead of winter, and it boasted in its time an ancient, medieval, and then modern Jewish community of great prominence prior to the Holocaust. Jews moved into Bohemian Moravia, the Czech lands, in the Middle Ages before the year 1000, and the Jewish community was awarded its own flag in 1357 by the Holy Roman Emperor. That's the first use of a Jewish star as a purely Jewish symbol, the Magen David that is now the flag of the State of Israel. While Jews in Prague were subject to the same persecutions we endured everywhere in Europe over the centuries, the city developed its own traditions of great scholarship and a deep fascination with Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. In the 16th century and 17th century, during the Prague Renaissance, the Jewish ghetto became a center of Kabbalah. The Maharal of Prague is the greatest figure in the history of the Jews of that region, a wonderful, accomplished, and highly influential scholar. And his synagogue, the Altneu Shul, still stands intact at 700 years, the oldest continuously used synagogue in Europe. The Maharal met with the Emperor Rudolf II and discussed Kabbalah with him. Legend has it that this Maharal of Prague created the Golem, the mystical monster who successfully defended the Jews against their evil attackers. Unlike nearly every city occupied by the Nazis, the varied and beautiful synagogues of Prague survived the Holocaust. Although about 90% of the Czech Jews were slaughtered and half the survivors immigrated to Israel after the war, Hitler decided to preserve the picturesque synagogues of the Josefov, the old Jewish area, as well as the famous Prague Cemetery with its many crowded and jutting tombstones and monuments, as a kind of museum for extinct peoples to be opened after World War II. Today, some of the synagogues there are used for services by the small but active Prague Jewish community, including the Altneu Shul, which is used for Orthodox minyans, and the ornately beautiful Spanish synagogue, which is used for Reform Shabbat services. The Pinchas Synagogue, where Franz Kafka attended Shul, has now been transformed into a haunting memorial to the murdered Jews of Czechoslovakia, while the Meisel Synagogue has become an outstanding small museum of the history of Czech Jews. Reinhard Heydrich, Yimach Shmo, the fourth highest man in the Nazi hierarchy, was the initiator of the final solution to annihilate the Jews of Europe through genocide. Heydrich was sent to occupied Czechoslovakia, where, for his brutality, he became known as the Butcher of Prague. His assassination at the hands of Czech agents in Prague in 1942 provoked horrifying reprisals by the Germans against the Czechs. We saw the monument that marks the location of the attack that mortally wounded this evil man. On our last day in the Czech Republic, Wendy and I had a tour of Theresienstadt, the Theresien concentration camp complex located an hour from Prague. This was the show camp the Nazis created to pretend to the Red Cross how very well they were treating the Jews. A famous propaganda film was made, The Führer Gives the Jews a City, it was entitled. They had it directed by a prominent Jewish filmmaker who was sent to his death in Auschwitz after he completed the movie. It shows Jews playing soccer, watching a play, listening to an orchestra, appearing happy and content. Almost all the Jews in this propaganda film were sent afterwards to Auschwitz and their death. Our guide on our tour was a fascinating man. He showed us a historical journal featuring a glamour photo of his mother. Both of his parents were survivors of Theresienstadt. His mother was an actress who starred in the Czech-language cabarets the Nazis encouraged the prisoners to produce. His father wrote and composed the music and starred in the cabarets himself, and that's where his parents met. They married secretly in the Theresienstadt concentration camp and again in a public ceremony after they survived the war. Only about 15% of the inmates of Theresienstadt did survive. Our guide and his brothers were raised without even knowing they were Jewish. His parents saw no advantage to telling their children about their heritage in the wake of the Holocaust, during a communist regime in which no religious expression was acceptable. Eventually, he and his brothers found out they were Jewish and began the long process of exploring their identities. Our guide visited Israel, and although his main career was as a mathematics professor, he decided to become a Jewish tour guide for Prague and Terezin. A remarkable but not entirely unusual story in this fascinating and damaged part of the world. We saw pictures of the cabaret posters and some of the people in them when we were in Theresienstadt showing his parents. Theresienstadt was also the camp where many composers were interned, including Victor Ullmann, whose opera The Kaiser of Atlantis was composed in Theresien but not permitted to be performed by the Nazis. The famed Czech children's opera Brundibar was first performed in Theresienstadt, put on by the composer and original cast who had all been deported from Prague as Jews. Eventually, Brundibar was filmed for a Nazi propaganda movie, and then all the participants in this Theresienstadt production were herded into cattle trucks and sent to Auschwitz as soon as the filming was finished. Most were gassed immediately upon arrival, including the children, the composer, Hans Krause, the director, Kurt Giron, and the musicians. You know, more than 70 years after the end of the Shoah, the destruction of so many brilliant, talented, good human beings, and of this great Jewish world of genius and humanity by the concentrated evil of the Nazis still has the capacity to shock and horrify. Our Prague's guide's parents survived, but the vast majority of the artists, poets, composers, violinists, pianists, dancers, designers, and authors were murdered. Nearly all the children, including those who wrote that wonderful book of poetry, I Never Saw Another Butterfly, nearly all of them died either of disease or were murdered in Auschwitz. You know, I was asked last week if such a genocide could occur in the world again. I answered, of course. A form of it's happening in Syria right now, where ISIS murders all Christians in some areas and all Yazidis in others, while the butcher president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, gasses and bombs his own people with Russian help. It is true that we have not seen another Shoah in which more than half the Jews of the world were annihilated, but since the end of World War II, we have seen attempted genocide in Cambodia's killing fields, in Bosnia, in Rwanda. It can happen again. In some ways, it is happening again right now. And it should come as no surprise that, again, the world's response has been at best weak when faced with genocidal acts. At worst, as in Syria, we are again watching a humanitarian crisis disintegrate passively from chaos to multiplied horror. I'm sorry to begin with so much darkness today, but it's hard to sit silently, having just visited a center of the Shoah's destruction, and realizing we still haven't learned those lessons after 70 years. On a much lighter note, It is rodeo week coming here in Tucson, Arizona, in the heart of the Wild West where I live, so we need some Western themes this morning. You can't really understand what a big deal rodeo week is in Tucson unless you live here and have lived here for a while, you know, like 18 years like me. Here in Tucson, rodeo week consists of a big parade followed by, this will shock you, a rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple days to go to the parade and wear cowboy boots and hats. Or, you know, sometimes go to Disneyland. And we generally pretend we still have some connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. When you live in the West, not far from Tombstone in what was Apache country not much over a century ago, rodeo is still a big deal. You might not immediately associate Jews with cowboys, but there were Jews even in the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger of Tombstone and lawman Wyatt Earp's common law wife, his last one, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. There were Jewish mayors, sheriffs, and outlaws. If you don't know that, go and visit Boot Hill's Jewish Cemetery in Tombstone itself. And so, in honor of all those Jewish cowboys and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West. Long before saddles blazed across the West, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked into Saul Saloon like a man insane and ordered 3 fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
Well, finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Really?
That was the Ballad of Irving, redefining the word classic by itself. All about being Jewish, or too Jewish, in the Wild West. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami, is a young Reform rabbi who serves congregations in both Austria and France. Find out firsthand what it's like to be Jewish in Europe today, what security concerns affect Jews and rabbis there, and how Reform Judaism is working today in Europe, all when we return in just a moment on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
I am delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning. Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami is the rabbi of Or Chadash Synagogue in Vienna, Austria, and simultaneously the Liberal Synagogue in Toulouse, France. He was recently ordained and serves congregations in two separate countries in Europe and has part of the Reform movement's growth and development in Europe today. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure to meet you in Vienna. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to serve two congregations in two countries. And how it is going back and forth, just the mere mechanics of that experience.
I love serving both communities, and it certainly is a struggle sometimes. I have an apartment here in France where I'm right now. I have an apartment in Vienna. Sometimes I don't remember what stuff I have in Vienna, what I have in Toulouse. Sometimes I find myself not remembering which language I'm supposed to speak in, especially if there are some detours that I'll have to take, you know, flying over Paris and other places. But it is a great experience. There are two completely different communities. The community in France is mostly Sephardi. The community in Vienna is very Ashkenazi, as one expects, but I really enjoy it, and also the life between two completely different cities.
So let's start by talking about the Viennese Jewish community. It's a German-speaking, but services are in German and English and, of course, Hebrew. Tell me about that Viennese Jewish community.
So Or Chadash in Vienna is a community that was founded 25 years ago by Viennese, but also by a lot of expats. So we have also a lot of Americans who are working at the UN. So our services are both in Hebrew, German, and English. Some things I will say in English, some things I'll say in German, and it's a wonderful and very dynamic community, especially because of its international membership. We have a lot of people that add a lot of things, but, I mean, unfortunately, they then have to leave after a couple of years. But we always have constantly international guests and people who join our community.
For example, I think you had the ambassador, the Israeli ambassador to Vienna, a really interesting woman ambassador, actually came for the High Holidays this year to Or Chadash, to your congregation.
Yes, she came to Or Chadash instead of going to the Stadt Temple and joined us for services. And she will also be coming on different other occasions. She will be there for my installation service, which is in the end of March.
Mazel tov in advance. We will talk much more with Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami here, a little bit about the Jewish community in Toulouse, France, but also about the security concerns in both places and for Jews in Europe more broadly, and the growth of liberal Judaism in Europe when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. We welcome our friends from Freedom Smoke, David and Pamela. You guys focus so much on your customers. Tell us why they're so important to you.
Our customers are extremely important to us. It's why we built this company. Our job is to get people to quit smoking, and we're extremely good at it. You can come in a very nice, comfortable lounge environment. Try anything you want to try. You'll have knowledgeable and helpful staff that will be happy to get you or your family and loved ones to quit smoking.
We have 4 locations in Tucson, 1 in Catalina on the Pinal border, and our latest store has just opened in Sierra Vista.
And these are all lounges, sort of a comfortable environment for people to come in.
Yes, they're set up with couches and pool tables, pinball machines, video games, anything to help you along with your time.
What's the best way for people to find out more information?
They can go onto our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call our toll-free hotline for any information that you want, 1-800-705-7013.
And that number again is
1-800-705-7013.
Thanks so much. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was a recent statement by the president on International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And in that statement, he had sort of general things to say about the terrible facts of the Holocaust, but he did not mention Jews, which goes against recent presidential tradition. And it seems shocking to Jews not to mention Jews when you're talking about the Shoah.
Yeah, there was a very strong public reaction to that, in part because I think a lot of people have expected the new president to be pro-Jewish, given his family circumstances, pro-Israel, given his cozy relationship with Netanyahu, et cetera, et cetera. And in this first public statement, where he had clear opportunity and clear precedent for mentioning Jews, he dramatically omitted them. But there's also an interesting history to Jewish attitudes towards the Holocaust tend to be that it was our tragedy. And we often forget that it was a tragedy for all of Europe and that many other groups were also victims. We may have been first among equals. There may have been more Jewish victims than anybody else. It may have been originally designed to eliminate Jews. But in the end, there were a lot of other victims. And so when, for example, the Roman Catholic Church wanted to erect a monument at the entrance to Auschwitz to a Catholic woman who subsequently was sainted and who was killed in Auschwitz, there was widespread protest in the Jewish world at the attempt, or what was perceived as the attempt of the Catholic Church to appropriate a uniquely Jewish tragedy, and particularly something as symbolic of that tragedy as Auschwitz. Is that a legitimate protest? I honestly don't know. I mean, I think you can make an argument in both directions that a lot of people were affected tragically by the Holocaust, and it's not a uniquely or exclusively Jewish tragedy. But for this president, and particularly this president, to be the first president in recent memory to ignore the Jewish aspect of the tragedy in his statement on International Holocaust Day seems to have raised a lot of hackles and a lot of questions.
One can hope that awareness of, and I don't know if sensitivity is something we can expect from this administration, but an awareness of the need to be inclusive, not just in a general sense, but of those who are most immediately affected, would begin to develop. And with Jews in position to influence that, one would hope that that would come across. But so far, not so much.
Plus, I mean, in general, one would hope that the president will learn to take more time and more care in having his public statements vetted by a variety of advisors and counselors, and not just speak off the cuff as much as he tends to do, has tended to do in the past.
Tom, thanks very much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome one of our Shin Shinim, Leah Avuno, who's representing the Weintraub Israel Center magnificently here in Southern Arizona as part of this great program. Leah, welcome back.
Thank you.
You want to talk about one of the great leaders of Israel who died last year, Shimon Peres.
Yes, he died actually on September 28th of 2016. And I figured that it will be very important and meaningful if I'll talk about him this radio show.
Now, Peres has a different kind of reputation in Israel than he has around the world. Not necessarily better or worse either place, but you certainly knew him much better than most of the rest of us. Tell us what people think about Peres.
I feel like he's the grandpa of everyone in Israel, and like everybody in every generation appreciate him. He never like did something that was shocking on, or like, I don't know how to explain it. It's just someone that you really know how to appreciate and love, and you always like worried about him. And like, that's funny that even the young children are like, oh my gosh, Shimon Peres passed away. Like, even the little children are aware of who he was and all the amazing thing he did. And he also had a very strong and meaningful connection with my community, with the Ethiopian community. He was the prime minister, the minister of defense, and
the foreign minister, the president.
Yeah, he was everything basically. But
helped start the Israeli Air Force, helped start the Israeli nuclear program that nobody talks about, all of it.
Right, nachon. And when he was the prime minister, Operation Moses took place. And he actually wrote a song for the Ethiopian community that Idan Rachel, that came to Tucson, I know, perform. And
people don't know he wrote poetry all the time. He wrote lots of songs. It's very not something you expect from someone in that position.
That's true. He was very talented. I don't know how he had time, but he did. And he also went to Ethiopia once with Yitzhak Rabin, Zichrono Livracha, and he always loved to compare himself to the Ethiopian generation, because he was born in Poland and he came to Israel. He made Aliyah in 34 with his mother, and he spoke Yiddish, so he always said things in Yiddish and not in Hebrew, like modern Hebrew, so people would make fun of him and stuff. So he always loved to tell stories of how he was like the funny kid, the not knowing Hebrew kid, and now he's the president, so that's funny, and that's like, I understand him.
Yeah, so immigrants to Israel, and almost everybody in Israel comes from one or two generations of immigrants anyway,
yes,
could really relate to him. I saw a great YouTube video after he was finishing his presidency. He was in his 90s, and it was like, what's your next career going to be? Shimmy.
Yeah.
And they showed him like working as a gas station attendant, and he went along with this, right? Selling falafel. It was the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's why the reason why everybody love him, because he has such a good humor, and he's just like, he's matching himself to the generation every time. And that's, you need to be really talented to do that.
Thanks for some beautiful memories of Shimon Peres.
Thanks,
Lynn. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates serving Tucsonians living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Good morning. Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So this is kind of a
complicated question today than it used to be. What's the right age to start your kid in a formal Jewish educational setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and my first thought is, well, there's never a wrong age to get started if you haven't.
In utero, start playing Jewish
music. Of
course, music,
and that's the next answer, right? The little headphones with hatikvah.
This is a hamantash, and I'm taking a bite now. Yeah.
So it's so important to kind of invest time when kids are young to get them inspired early and connecting early and doing things, experiencing some of the ritual, some of the festival that comes with our rich tradition. And it's really ripe for children too. We see in many of the holidays an emphasis on the child having a great experience. And so as kids are learning to read, basic literacy skills, there's opportunity in Tucson with a thing called PJ Library. And it's a great way to start.
Yeah, the big event that today, actually, at Temple Emanuel.
Oh, they have it today. Oh, that's great. So, you know, and
free
then,
books for all kinds of preschool up through, I don't know what they're up to.
They go up to middle school
middle
now.
School age.
Yeah,
now.
That's
yeah,
PJ Arway up in the middle school. But, you know, as we love having babies around, and, you know, it's just, I don't know about like a starting point, but when it is just what the family does, it kind of has a holistic feeling and it's a norm and it's what we do. It's the rhythm of our days and our lives. So,
two things. One is, it's actually easier to learn a language the earlier you start. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to have kids begin to start Hebrew, mm-hmm. kindergarten, first grade, not too early at all, is it?
Sure. And even in preschool, as kids are starting to learn letters and recognizing letter sounds and language sounds and making the connection, the one-to-one correspondence with, this is the sound, this is what it looks like, and this is what it's called, a bet and a b. Great ways to connect.
And it's so much easier for them at that age than for old people like, you know, me.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of brain research about this. And, you know, it's not all about roses, but the brain actually is stronger and memory skills are sharper and thinking is better when you grow up with two languages. It may take longer for you to arrive as a full communicator in both of those languages.
But you'll be better once you get there.
Yeah, and starting them early is essential. You know, and speaking of early learning, we have a great opportunity today to get to know THA for families who might be interested, new and prospective families. We have a K-1 open house. You get a chance to meet the kindergarten and first grade teachers and some of the other team, see the school, check out classrooms, and for the kids to have a nice experience at THA. So that's at 12:15 today for that early learning experience.
Great introduction. And by the way, you can still belong to a temple. It works out
Please,
really well.
We'd love to see both.
Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A gorgeous woman gets on a bus, clearly distraught. She sits down next to a guy. She's very upset and finally can contain herself no longer. She turns to the man and says, "I just saw my therapist. He says I have a huge problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks conversationally. She says, "I can't tell you. I don't even know you." The guy says, "Well, you know, sometimes it's good to tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." The girl says, "Well, my therapist just told me I'm a nymphomaniac and I only like Jewish cowboys." "Wow, that feels good. By the way, now that you know, my name is Susan." And the guy says, "Oh, hi, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you and just for rodeo. You should live and be well and be a Jewish cowboy. And now a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we read the portion of Mishpatim, a section that includes as many laws as nearly any other part of the whole Torah. To tell the truth, after the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic Torah portions featuring some of the highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, indeed all religious history, Mishpatim is a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. And then the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians. Pharaoh and Moses had a duel of wills in the desert, and we found freedom. But this week's portion of Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. That's what a mishpat is, a law of human interaction. How exciting. How to handle somebody's property fairly. How to assess punitive damage for a man who injures another person or destroys someone else's stuff. How to act when somebody puts his or her property in trust with you. What to do if you find a lost object. Laws of manslaughter, theft, damage, and accidental injury. Rules about interest on loans, and on and on. If the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not to belong here at all. Shouldn't this stuff be in some commentary somewhere rather than here in the heart of the Torah? So why do we have these mishpatim at all? I believe that there's a profound lesson about our essential nature to be found here. Most of us really don't like rules. We love freedom, not rules. Rules bind us and restrict us, prevent us from doing what we want to do when we want to do it, frustrate us, limit us in arbitrary ways. And the most specific and important kind of rules our society has is a code of laws. So naturally, since we don't love law, we don't like its practitioners. Lawyer jokes wouldn't be so popular if there wasn't a profound ambivalence about the whole profession and its actions. You can make a case that the dismal reputation politicians have is in part attributable to the fact that most of them originally practiced law. Let's face it, we don't like laws, but without them. Without them and without enforcement of them, we fallible human beings wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. And that's where our portion of Mishpatim comes in. We need law and its limits, although we might not like either one. Judaism understands that if we are truly to be good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. If we can successfully do that, we will learn to treat one another with holiness, and then, as Mishpatim teaches us, we might just find God. At the end of this week's portion, after all these rules and laws, these torts and talionises, God actually reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. The lesson is clear. We can only see real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women. When we come to understand that we are all in this together and that the way to God is through the ways we learn to work together, we will learn to trust one another. The American Jewish poet Adrienne Rich puts it very well indeed in her poem On Memory. Freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds. Using these little mishpatim, inch by inch, to make this world good and therefore free, and then, maybe, holy. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami, will tell us what it's like to serve congregations in two different countries and find out what the current climate for Reform Judaism is in modern-day Europe. Find out when we return here on To Jewish.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates, serving Tucsonans living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu met in Washington last week for the first time since the election and seemed to get along famously. Trump spoke glowingly about Israel. Netanyahu said there is no greater supporter of the Jewish people and the Jewish state than President Donald Trump. Trump did casually say that he wished Israel would hold back on settlements. Both men seemed to back away from any two-state solution, and Trump said that he would love to see the U.S. embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, but made no promises to do so soon. We will see. In Montreal, Canada, a McGill University student leader who advised on Twitter, "Punch a Zionist today," is refusing to resign or retract the comment amid rising Jewish anger on campus. Council member Igor Sadikov did not relent at a tense meeting of the Student Union Legislative Council last week. Instead, he doubled down on his stance, arguing that Jews were not a legitimate ethnic group. Jewish McGill student Molly Harris later wrote, "I have never felt so targeted, disgusted, or disappointed in my life." Sadikov is also active in the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement against Israel. He denies that he's anti-Semitic, noting his father is Jewish. He said his original tweet, which he later deleted, was meant to criticize a political philosophy, not Jews. McGill University condemns Sadikov, joining B'nai B'rith, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center in that. The university's undergraduates' arts society formally called on him to resign, but he didn't do it. B'nai B'rith asked police to investigate whether Sadikov had incited hatred with his "Punch a Zionist" tweet. The mass condemnation did little to appease pro-Israel students at McGill, who say they feel increasingly isolated and vulnerable on that campus. At the meeting, council members voted by a wide margin against censoring Sadikov. While a leader of McGill's BDS group asked why an individual pro-Zionist member of the council was not being impeached, the campus newspaper, the McGill Daily, which Sadikov once edited, recently enacted a policy to ban pro-Zionist opinion from its pages. In happier news, 102 members of the B'nai Menashe Indian Jewish community immigrated to Israel last week. The aliyah was facilitated by the Jerusalem-based nonprofit Shavei Israel, which works to strengthen ties between the Jewish people and descendants of Jews around the world. These over 100 new immigrants come from the northeastern Indian state of Mizoram, which borders Myanmar and Bangladesh, and is home to the second largest concentration of B'nai Menashe in India. After the state of Manipur, this week's aliyah marks the first time since January of 2014 that the B'nai Menashe have immigrated from Mizoram. The Olim, the new immigrants, plan to make their homes in Nazareth Elite, following in the footsteps of other members of the B'nai Menashe Indian Jewish community. Shavei Israel founder and chairman Michael Freund said that last week's arrivals mark the launch of Operation Menashe, that is Manasseh, 2017. Over the course of the coming year, with God's help, we'll bring a total of more than 700 B'nai Menashe immigrants to Israel, the largest ever airlift from India in a single year. After 27 centuries of exile, this lost tribe of Israel is truly coming home, but we will not rest until all the remaining B'nai Menashe still in India are able to make aliyah as well. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our very engaging guest. He's Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami, the rabbi of Or Chadash Synagogue in Vienna, Austria, and simultaneously the rabbi of the Liberal Synagogue in Toulouse, France. He was ordained in Europe, in Germany, at the seminary, and speaks German, English, Hebrew, French. Did I miss any languages?
And Spanish.
And Spanish. Yeah. Claro que sí. We spoke earlier about the Jewish community in Vienna, which is very interesting. They talk about it as the fourth Jewish community because each of the other three ended with either expulsion or destruction. Tell me a little bit about the Jewish community that you serve in Toulouse, France.
So in Toulouse, France, the community is about 20 years old. Most of it, I would say to 85%, is of Sephardi background. because of the immigrations after the wars in the colonies.
So those are Jews from Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia.
Tunisia, from Northern Africa, which sometimes can be challenging, especially if you have an Ashkenazi rabbi who's also from Germany on top of that. But it's a very engaging community. It's a very active community. It's a growing community, as we're the only liberal community in this part of France. And it's just a wonderful community.
In France, it's a different... let's talk about the security situation a little bit. When I met you in Vienna, although there was, you know, some concern about security, it seemed not particularly acute. That's not the case in France.
No. So in Vienna, we do have police observing the community buildings, and we have security guards. But here in France, we live in a completely different situation. So when we have services and when we have different activities, such as religious school, we will also have soldiers inside the building and outside of the building. Our rules here concerning security are very, very strict. So I can, for example, not meet someone that I don't already know, unless that person has spoken to the Security Council first. The security that is being imposed on the Jewish communities here by the Jewish communities themselves is very strict.
When somebody comes to the door, unless you personally know them, you're not permitted to let them in, I heard you say?
Yes. I'm not allowed to let a person in that I don't personally know, unless this has been passed by the Security Council first, which can provide challenges, especially if you've been a member for 20 years, but I don't know you and I'm the only person in the synagogue. I'm technically not allowed to let you in.
So then you have to go meet people in cafes or restaurants or in their homes?
I'm also advised not to meet strangers that I don't know outside of the synagogue. It's just security, especially after the attacks we've had here in Toulouse on the Jewish school and the supermarket in 2012.
Right.
Security has been very, very much enforced, and my board is very strict. And it's just to protect myself and to protect the community.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about Reform Judaism in Western Europe and Central Europe. I think for many Jews, we grew up in America, we tend to think Reform Judaism is a large, maybe the majority movement in the United States. Certainly not the case in Europe. Although, of course, it comes from Germany originally, Austria, part of that German Jewish area. Explore, if you would, in a little more kind of a broader sense, the growth of Reform Judaism today in Europe.
So Europe is certainly the cradle of Reform and liberal Judaism, and was the birth. Germany was the birthplace of Reform Judaism, and it was until the Holocaust the largest movement in Europe, both in Austria as well as also in France and Germany certainly. But after the Holocaust, most of the communities had been destroyed, or its members said, fortunately, emigrated to the United States. So the people we had here in Europe were, a lot of them were displaced persons who came from a different tradition that was certainly more Orthodox. The rebirth of liberal Judaism began in the 1980s, and from then on, liberal Judaism began to grow again. But we're still a very small movement. We certainly are a bigger movement in Germany. Or Chadash in Vienna is the only progressive community in all of Austria. And in France, it's still a growing... liberal Judaism is growing, but it still is not as strong as it is in the United States.
How do you explain Reform Judaism to, say, a Jewish family from Tunisia, Morocco, who had never heard of it?
That can sometimes be the most challenging. I very often have people from Tunisia and from a very traditional Northern African background here for bar and bat mitzvah. And those can be the most awkward situations in which people are very standoffish because we're not a real community to them. And all of the, you know, men and women sitting together is not how it's supposed to be. But then when you suddenly have a mother or a daughter come up to the Torah, being called up to the Torah for the first time, you can see a complete change even in the person that was most standoffish in the beginning. We try to explain to them that Judaism has always developed. It has developed in the Bible. It has developed from the destruction of the temple to rabbinic Judaism, and it has, even within rabbinic Judaism until today, Judaism has always developed, and it's just natural that the 21st century does not stop in front of the gates of a synagogue, but comes with us into the synagogue.
It's a different kind of situation in Vienna. As in everywhere in Europe, there seems to be a strong Orthodox presence, although not something that the majority of the Jews participate in. How do you go about bringing together a really diverse community? As I understand, in Vienna, there are Jews from the former Soviet Union. There are the international people traveling through, the American expats. How do you kind of work to knit that all together into a coherent kahila?
So what we especially base ourselves on are cultural and cultural events and socializing opportunities. And once you've had people socialize and feel comfortable and feel welcome in a community, they will also feel welcome to come to services and then actually enjoy the conviviality of the community. And especially when it comes to services, both communities love to sing, and engaging people in song and in prayer brings people together. So that is what we especially focus on, both here in France and in Vienna.
What's your favorite part about each community?
I love Vienna's international community. It is sort of what I grew up with. I had a very international upbringing, so that's where I feel at home. Also, the melodies they use are melodies from the community that I grew up with, because the rabbi was the same rabbi. Here in France, I've grown to really like the Sephardi traditions, and but both communities are very warm and very welcoming. It's both cities and countries that I'd never lived in or visited, and I was just welcomed very, very warmly, and they made me feel at home.
Tell us a little bit about your background, because as you noted, it's a very international one. It's an unusual one.
It is. I was born to a German-Swiss family. My mother's side of the family is originally from Germany. My father's side of the family is from Switzerland originally. Most of my mother's side of the family lives in the United States, so that explains my very thick German accent. I spend all of my summers in Montana. And
where in Montana? You have to share that as well.
It's right in between East and West Glacier. It's on Highway 2, and the place is called Pinnacle, but it's not really a place where people live. I think there are about 15 inhabitants there that live there all year round, and usually people come for the summer.
Not counting the bears, of course.
Not counting the bears and the mountain lions and whatever else there is that could attack and kill you. But because of that, I've had a very international upbringing, and I was raised with both English and German, and both the American culture and the German and Swiss cultures were part of our family culture and our family way of life.
Do you feel that the Reform congregations are growing in Vienna and in Toulouse in your own congregation?
Definitely. Both congregations are growing because they're offering an alternative to what people know, an alternative that is inclusive, that is open-minded, and that is welcoming.
And what can we do to find out more about these really interesting Jewish communities and about Reform Judaism, Liberal Judaism in Europe today?
You can go online and check out our websites, both of Or Chadash in Vienna and of the AJLT in Toulouse. You can come and visit. If you are ever coming to Vienna, stop by. We are always happy to welcome you for a Friday night or a Saturday morning service or for a holiday service. And the same goes for Friday night and Saturday morning services if you're ever in southern France.
I want to thank Rabbi Lior Bar-Ami for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I just want to say, do you get to keep the frequent flyer miles?
I do. I actually have to pay my own flight, so I keep the frequent flyer miles, and I'm going to make good use of them.
I was going to say, this sounds like an around the world tour is coming sooner or later. Thanks again, Lior, and a continued success. And we'll check back with you just to see how things are going.
Great. I thank you for this wonderful interview, and I have a great day.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here on Too Jewish this morning with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Richard Address, the upcoming Bill Gray Lectureship Scholar at Temple Emmanuel the first weekend of March, discussing health, wellness, and sacred aging in Judaism. And of course, listen to all our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the Maccabees. It's their tribute to Leonard Cohen. It's Lecha Dodi, set to Cohen's music for Hallelujah. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.